All right, I think we're good. Welcome back to Colonial Outcast. This is an impromptu, shorter episode about Rafa. This is Monday, March 11th. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's some BS about an aid port. There's been some fatal airdrops continuing, and this ongoing humanitarian crisis is a massive, I would say political blunder, amongst other things, like a humanitarian catastrophe. But today we are joined by my friend Matthew Enderlin. He was an active duty Army officer for 8 years, deployed to Afghanistan in 2014. And after leaving the Army, he worked as an anti-poaching advisor for conservation NGOs in Central Africa and Lebanon. Currently living in Egypt, just went by, tried to get into Rafah a couple days ago, sent a video, and we're just kind of hoping we get the situation on the ground. And then we're going to spend the second half of the episode talking about this aid port coming in, or this proposed aid port that's going to be built in, what, 2 months? So, Matt, thanks for coming on today.
Matt's frozen.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. We're kind of coordinating halfway around the globe, so there may be some lag time. Apologies for the listeners. All right, man. So you just got back from Rafah. You said, I think when you texted me the message, it says you had some trouble making it there. The police outside of Erish turned you back, but you could see hundreds of AIDS trucks, and you sent a video, which we're going to play shortly, and you spoke to like a lot of drivers on what is happening on both sides of the border.
Yes, correct. The idea was to make it to Rafah and just try to discover what actually is happening on the ground in terms of the where and how the aid is being blocked and what challenges that that these drivers meet along the way. Unfortunately, I was not able to make it there, which was not too much of a surprise because it is a difficult place to access without permission from the government or without access through an NGO or aid organization or some other entity like that. So I did make it almost to El Arish, and before we were turned back by police. But it was not a failure at all, because in that road that runs from Cairo through the Suez Canal and then into North Sinai and then along the Mediterranean, eventually terminating in Rafah, I was able to see what probably was at least 1,000 aid trucks at various points along the journey. And I was able to speak with many of the drivers and try to understand what's going on.
All right. Yeah. And so when we say thousands of aid trucks, you sent me this video, and yeah, it's quite stunning. The traffic backup, I'm going to throw it up now. All right. Yeah. So looks like miles and miles of just backed up trucks. They've been there for days, weeks. I don't know how long. Could you just walk us through like what this process is for the drivers? Like what's going on with those border security, just whatever springs to mind.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think probably for the average person who is not familiar with the situation in Sinai and especially North Sinai, you imagine an aid truck leaving, a port or Cairo and going all the way to Rafah and then being stopped there. And many people have heard about the myriad problems that they have at the border crossing. But the situation on the ground is actually significantly more complex, in that it's important to understand that the North Sinai is the Egyptian government has been fighting a low intensity conflict there for about the past 10 years. And as a result of that, the area throughout the region is a security zone where you have to pass through checkpoints and have to deal with various entities in the Egyptian security. Did you have a...
I just wanted to say real quick, could you just take a moment and explain for our listeners what the low intensity conflict in the Sinai is between the local governments and partisans? I assume you're talking about the Bedouin.
Yes. So for everyone's understanding, the indigenous population of Sinai is a number of Bedouin tribes who have lived in the region since millennia. And that has been the source of a lot of conflict and a lot of neglect throughout history. In most recent terms, the conflict started about the time that Sisi took power in 2013. And of course, you know that his predecessor was supported by the Muslim Brotherhood. And the ties and alliances and like the both national, subnational, and tribal politics are really quite complicated and probably not worth getting into for the purposes of this discussion. But it is a heavily policed and militarized zone, especially in the North Sinai. Most of the conflict in the past few years has been centered around the area around Arish. And there you just see various small to medium to large security incidents that happen in terms of checkpoints being attacked, IEDs, and the problem actually is quite complex and quite intertwined with the politics of the region, and then a lot of what happens inside occupied Palestine and Gaza as well, because of the existence of tunnels, smuggling routes, and other activities like that. So that region, when you drive through it, you have to go through a police or military checkpoint every maybe 10 to 15 miles. And there's various levels of scrutiny and time and paperwork that's required to pass those. You also have that area that you will have to cross if you want to bring an aid truck from the mainland of Egypt into Sinai and then eventually into Gaza, the Suez Canal, which is, as you can understand, a heavily secured and militarized zone. Also requires a significant amount of permission. So essentially, a truck leaving Cairo and going all the way to Rafah will have to meet these checkpoints along the way, and will have to have inspections, paperwork, you know, everything in order. And the reality on the ground is that there are significant delays that are happening all along the way. So it's not just an instance of an aid truck being stopped by protesters or by Israeli forces or any other entity at the border. It may take a truck 10 days to 2 weeks, up to a month or more, to make it from Cairo just to the border. And then the challenges of getting through the border, meeting those requirements and the problems of fare. And then not to mention, once the aid reaches and can get inside Gaza, the problem of the last mile distribution is also a huge problem.
Right. And just for clarity, I get asked a lot, and if you could state this definitively, people ask, why doesn't Egypt just open up the border into the border crossing into Gaza? Because I think there is an impression that aid is getting could go from Egypt directly into the Rafah crossing.
Yeah, I mean, that most of the aid that goes through now does go through that crossing.
Right.
The vast majority of trucks go through the Rafah crossing. They do not go to the Kerem Shalom crossing. Before the conflict, it was the opposite, as I understood it. But because of the challenges and more than likely the deliberate efforts of protesters and the Israeli government to block aid, they're forced to use the Rafah crossing. And to expound on that further, these like the Rafah crossing was not open for various times throughout the past 10 years because of other security incidents. It's only been open in a regular capacity for the last few years, as I understand it. And it is not originally designed and built as a commercialized crossing for commercial shipping. It's more of a pedestrian and crossing for a small amount of goods or people to move back and forth.
Yeah, who is in charge? Who is in charge of the security of the Rafa crossing? Stating definitively for everybody.
Yeah, that actually, I since I was not able to reach there, I fully do not understand that definitively. That I have read that when the negotiations happened between the Egyptian government and the Israeli government. A few years ago, in opening it, so that one of the stipulations was that checkpoint would be manned only by Palestinians. But I do not know if that is the actual case on the ground or not.
Right, and there's a lot of confusion with inside Rafah itself too, because I'm speaking to people like currently displaced in that area of southern Gaza. So. When we talk about the drivers trying to get aid in, what have they been saying in general terms, general themes about challenges, hurdles?
I mean, it's just a giant administrative problem from point A to point B. I spoke to drivers who were stuck at the crossing of the Suez Canal in Ismailia, which is you go from the mainland of Egypt into Sinai and then onward throughout the rest of Sinai to Rafah. And I spoke to some drivers there who had been stuck there for 2 to 3 weeks just to cross into Sinai. And then along the way, as you can see from that video, there's a number of most of the trucks I saw while I was there were not moving. They were stopped along the road. And they were at some administrative hurdle to get through the checkpoint to go through to the next stage. The ones I had spoke to who had made trips into occupied Palestine gave me reports of just general intimidation by occupation forces as well as protesters. And actually, one of the reasons that I wanted to go here and investigate it was because I don't know about you, but I was seeing videos at Nitzana and Kerem Shalom at these crossings with groups of like 10 protesters sitting in a circle and, of course, overwatched by some IOF soldiers. And to me, it just wasn't credible that 10 protesters sitting in a circle and singing songs could stop thousands of trucks moving through. So I wanted to see if we could find some evidence of the complicity of the occupation forces, you know, in those blockages. The drivers I spoke to, and I have to state that many of these drivers are wary and scared to speak on these issues because of the potential consequences to them. Just professionally and within Egypt, but I was able to speak to a few who were brave enough to tell me of the challenges that they face, and it's essentially what you're seeing in the news. I mean, they are intimidated at a very extreme level by occupation forces. Some drivers told me that immediately when they're crossing the border, that Israeli forces have guns up and trained at them as if they were a hostile threat, just automatically. And they were harassed by protesters and subjected to long and intense searches, you know, lasting 2 to 3 days on the short end to up to 10 days, from what I heard. And the point really to make is that when a truck leaves Cairo or anywhere else and is heading to Rafah, that just at every step of the way, the odds are against this truck of making a smooth passage. And that's just to the border. And then, of course, you have the challenges of, and I don't have direct evidence of this, but from people I've talked to, there's just not enough trucks within Rafah to distribute and take goods. So that is another reason that trucks are stopped through that border crossing. But the real question is why when before the conflict, You had most of the aid trucks that were going into Gaza were coming through the Kerem Shalom crossing. Why is that inverted now? And although it's hard to say directly with direct evidence, it only reinforces the position that and the idea that this is just a kind of a systematic and deliberate attempt at every level to limit aid getting into Gaza.
Yeah, I would go so far as to call it just straight up weaponized bureaucracy. That's, you know, what I've been hearing from the ground.
Yeah, makes sense.
How many trucks on average are actually getting through, if you know that, compared to a normal day prior to October?
The only figures I know from that are from open sources, so the same ones you would read, because on the ground you can't really, I'm speaking to individual truck drivers, and that knowledge just isn't on the ground.
Typically, where are these truckers from? Are they Egyptian?
Yeah, most of them are Egyptian. Yeah.
Gotcha. And are their motivation for doing this? They're humanitarian. They're being paid. They're hired. What's typically their drive for going through all this bullshit?
To be honest, going through all of this bullshit is just kind of the cost of doing business in Egypt. I mean, whether if they're having these problems, bringing aid to occupied Palestine, if they're not doing that, they're having similar problems moving supplies somewhere else. I mean, that's just the. It's not really a sense of this as being an extraordinary sort of like systematic blockage on the Egyptian side. It's just kind of business as usual,
Well, aside from the fact that the guns being pointed at them when they get to the Rafah crossing by the IOF, that I'm sure is not a typical day for these truck drivers, regardless of it. So to me, it takes a certain type of person to want to go through that type of physical harm, threat of harm and intimidation, as opposed to just going through a normal, you know, day of business.
Absolutely. And I will say everyone I spoke to had a almost unilaterally a sense of pride and I can say excitement. It's just you're doing your job, but you're part of something bigger, and you're part of bringing help and aid to people who are being starved and massacred. So I think that would make anyone feel good.
Yeah. And so that brings us to the next point. You know, you're going to have the continued administrative and what I would call like martial law nightmare imposed by both just the way of doing business in Egypt, but also the sanctions, the intimidation, and the brute force of the IOF. But now we've got the political stunt that is the port, the temporary aid port coming out of Cyprus to, you know, deliver food into Gaza. That seems like a military nightmare just waiting to happen. There's a lot of unhashed out details, like who is going to control the beachhead, because there's got to be a beachhead in order to get aid in there, because apparently the pier is going to take 2 months to construct. So they have a massive like aid ship coming in, and then they're going to like try to offload it on barges. There's a question of who's going to control security. Haaretz, the used to be relatively left-wing newspaper, is saying that it looks like the IDF is going to have to take charge of the beachhead, so we can expect more violence. The president has said there are going to be no U.S. boots on the ground, but there would be U.S. forces to secure the actual pier itself. As a former infantry officer, you know, what could possibly go wrong, right?
Just absolutely absurd from the you know, the top level down. I mean, I saw enough aid in a 3-hour drive up and down the highway in North Sinai to certainly sustain life for a lot of Gazans for a long time. And as I understand it, from where I got turned around, that the concentration of trucks only gets larger as you get to the border. So it is not a situation of delivering of the aid not already being in the area. But we already know that. And we already know that the US government has really only started to change some of its rhetoric and some of its actions now in the past few weeks, just because of the rapid collapse of political support or support for everything that has happened in Gaza since October 7th. So we saw that in terms of these aid drops, where we now have Palestinian children being killed by U.S. military aircraft that are dropping aid packages at the same time that U.S.-made bombs are dropping a few kilometers away. So from the standpoint of the port mission, the JLOTs, it's a mess. I mean, like you said, President Biden said there will be no U.S. boots on the ground. But just from the logic of how do you set this thing up? What's the idea that you will put a pier up on the beach and no U.S. military personnel will step off to organize the security of that from the first standpoint, and then beyond that, to organize the offloading and then distribution of aid. It's creating a massive target, in my opinion, where just a potential security incident and a threat to either U.S. forces, or it's going to be secured by IOF, who will then have an opportunity again to control the distribution of the aid and then perpetuate acts of violence against it in whatever way they see fit. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense.
Well, it's just about performative optics. It's about appeasement. It's what I've started to call liberal appeasement. It's like, okay, we're getting aid in. It also allows the US to kind of push back against claims of genocide complicity if they do that. Yeah, it's not feasible. It's like the most operationally inefficient way to deliver aid. It's just asking for another catastrophe and another massacre. But it does allow them to argue in court and obfuscate the issue and drag proceedings out and potentially the ICJ, because I mean there's lawsuits being launched by numerous third parties existentially towards the US to Biden for complicity in this.
It also gives them a great excuse to stall for time to maximize the amount of, Gazans who are starving. So 30 to 60 days, 30 to 60 days, how many Gazans are going to survive by that time from simply starvation and disease? It's a great way of just pushing the ball, kicking the can just a little bit more. And let's say there's construction issues. Let's say there's a security threat issue. Well, you can delay it another month. More thousands of Gazans are starving to death. You can keep playing this game. And to the American people, it's just like, oh, well, they just keep having problems. We're trying to get on it. We're trying to fix this. It's just a great psychological, placeholder for Americans. And they're doing it geniusly for the people who are that gullible to buy it, who don't kind of dig deep and don't listen to what people like you have to say about it, that can break down what exactly is happening and what the real problem is on the ground. For those who are simply fresh to the news, don't really dig more than like a CNN headline. To them, it's just very, it's that perfect talking point they can use when they're talking to friends who may be more concerned about what's happening in Gaza than them. So.
Yeah, and speaking of headlines, I just wanted to pull up this article published on Haaretz. Hey, is that how you pronounce it? You know better than
Haaretz.
that. Haaretz.
Well, I don't know. Who cares?
Okay. All right. Yeah. So this was just published a couple hours ago. I think it's pretty detached from reality. So U.S. built port could turn Israel into Gaza policing force. So it says the port may remove Israel's responsibility for the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Thinks nobody outside of Israel. But without an agreed upon authority, the risk of chaos grows. Obviously, in my opinion, the only faction or entity that could successfully distribute aid would be Hamas, but that would, you know, the actual official government organization inside Gaza, who, you know, at least has some amount of popularity with the people and respect from the people. But, you know, that would never happen. So the World Central Kitchen ship Open Arms has reached Larnaca port in Cyprus 3 weeks ago. It is supposed to do so, and it's supposed to set out in the next few hours, probably already set out by now. The ship is loaded with more than 200 tons of flour, rice, tuna, et cetera, other products. It's already been inspected by Israeli officials in Cyprus to ensure it does not carry military equipment. Okay. So they won't necessarily have that excuse, apparently, that they can just, you know, do ad nauseum border inspections coming out of Egypt. It's still unclear how this cargo will be unloaded. The temporary American pier, according to officials, may take up to 2 months. The intention is to begin by unloading the ship's cargo onto barges and small boats capable of mooring on the beach itself. And again, without a secure beachhead, you're going to have like hunger-maddened, starving individuals clamoring for food, because obviously that's what humans do in these situations. Again, we come back to the security nightmare and just asking for another massacre. You know, it just seems like a logistical, disorganized mess, just having random boats and barges landing all across a marine shore.
I'll start by saying, actually, you speak of the World Central Kitchen. I sat and had tea with drivers of a convoy of trucks of World Central Kitchen aid in North Sinai, which that's nothing more than a fun fact, but it says something that this aid from this specific organization is already in the region, is already on a truck that's gassed up and ready to take it to the border and then distribute it to people who are starving and dying. But we're going to create another incredibly expensive, dangerous, inefficient, and ridiculous solution to this problem that already has quite a clear and simple solution. And also, as we saw with the flour massacre, where the IOF blamed starving people swarming aid trucks as an excuse to massacre over 100 people, in my opinion, this is just creating other situations that will lead to instances just like that. And you can call it victim blaming, or you can call it baiting, or whatever you want. But the fact is that it serves the IOF's interest to have a situation where they can create a narrative of people swarming and creating in my opinion is probably likely a completely imagined threat, and then use that to either deny aid or to kill people.
Yeah, and I would like to reiterate the language they use when constructing those narratives, like stampede. You know, cattle stampede, bison stampede, humans don't. And some of these, you know, coming back to this article, I think it's very telling because they do get some analysis right. You know, it says, quote, this American humanitarian project doesn't only bypass Israel. It also eases the public pressure on Egyptian President al-Sisi to throw open the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza, which, of course, you live in Egypt. You know he doesn't want to do. We just talked about the low-intensity conflict in the Sinai. I can't imagine the Bedouin being too happy about accepting a million refugees onto their land. Also, the Egyptian economy can't really, you know, absorb it right now, even though they did get that massive IMF loan. It's just too many problems for that. And, of course, you know, they do want to keep Egypt on the sweet side. You know, everybody needs the Suez Canal. But also in this article, they say, quote, also this pier again, quote, denies Israel the option of using aid as a tool of warfare. And they obviously, whoever wrote this analysis, doesn't really understand that using aid as a tool of warfare is collective punishment, which is by definition a war crime. So there's this massive disconnect where they almost get there with what's really going on, but they cannot recognize that using aid as a tool of warfare is a war crime. And so whoever wrote this article, I'll post it in the description. Unfortunately, Haaretz is paywalled, so I've eaten this bullet for everybody, so you don't have to pay. I read it so you don't have to. But they basically always tell on themselves, admitting that, yes, this is to put pressure on Hamas. And a lot of people are mad about this port within Israel. Like, if you look on Zio Twitter, everyone's bashing Biden now. So friends like these.
I wanted to talk about the quiet part out loud. During the flower massacre, there was a recording that was done by soldiers that was leaked online. I don't know if you guys have heard about it, where they were talking about how they're waiting for them to start eating each other. It was a reference to the general attitude on the ground amongst IOF soldiers, where they are looking forward to the idea of seeing them dive into cannibalism as a means of further degradation of the Palestinian culture. And that is the going joke from what I've heard from people on the ground with the IOF soldier, is they're looking forward to that. They want to see these moments of desperation amongst the Palestinians as just a further, more of a sadistic satisfaction for them, you know? And that's going around. I think it's important that people look into that. And if that is the case and that recording is true, that, you know, that be researched and made known so that we can understand what we're dealing with and the type of attitude that's behind a lot of this.
Oh yeah. I think, go ahead, Matt. I'm going to circle back to the cannibalism element, but go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to, this is a complete and total societal dehumanization and dispossession of the Palestinian people, because they're, you know, we as veterans know that this level of inhumanity, of atrocity, and just a blatant disregard for other human beings is not something that is normal in terms of war.
Yeah.
In this day and age.
It's the whole reason why we fight war. It's the whole motivation that most soldiers sign to join up to prevent this type of dehumanization of human beings. It's the idea that we protect society from this type of evil, you know? And so whenever I see, you know, quote unquote army, military, or at least LARPers, you know, who are like, this is war, this is war. I hate that. I cannot stand to see that, of them just saying, well, that's war. War is war. It's like, no, that's not war. That is not war, you know? And you know who talks like that? Are people who have not seen war. That's the kind of general common denominator amongst dudes who talk like that, who appear to be like, you know, Rambo. They're people who have never seen war.
Yeah, and there's a lot of edgelord. There's a ton of edgelord vets out there that you know, are all about this. That I saw so many edgelord memes from like vets, like dudes who had like some supply non-combat position and like never went OCONUS, which is outside outside of the continental U.S. They're just like friggin', you know, making memes about the aid dropping on, like, the airdrop hitting and crushing children to death. And I want to try to present this screen, because we talked about cannibalism, how those soldiers were talking about how they Palestinians wanted to start like seeing them eat each other. Well, I'm trying to figure out this tech aspect, but if I can share the entire screen, I can bring up this Telegram channel. Oh, no, I can't, but it's the one called Dead Terrorists. Basically it's full of atrocity porn coming out of Gaza, which they're celebrating, and every caption has some reference to cannibalism in some way. And, you know, if you want to peruse those channels, I'd recommend against it. But yeah, this idea of mass famine and cannibalism is very appealing to all of these atrocity Telegram channels. And the one Dead Terrorist that I'm talking about has a pretty high engagement rate and 127,000 subscribers.
Yeah, and that kind of rhetoric cannot survive in the mainstream of a society, in my opinion.
Yes.
And the acts, the inhumane and terrible acts of violence against innocent civilians, that is not endured by a society unless it can dehumanize and separate this entire ethnic group of people from like any sort of responsibility for having any feelings of humanity. I mean, that's what I've understood over the past several months, and that's the only way I can rationalize that something like this can exist at such a high level.
And on a masculine level, as far as military speaking, it goes against every code of honor. It goes against every idea of honor. I don't know if you guys saw the statements made by Kid Rock on Joe Rogan's podcast, bragging it up, acting all hooah. He would be somebody's bitch in prison. Let's just say that, because harming children is even in American prison system, harming children is against the rules. And that's American prisons, where criminals are. And if they have that code of honor, even that ethical standard, that just goes to show how low this type of thinking is, that I don't think people realize, it's below the prison system. It's below the culture in prisons, the way they're talking about, because harming children is just the number one rule, the cardinal rule.
I mean, also, I would like to point out it's not just Israelis. Like, there are so many Americans jumping on this bandwagon too. Ones that like don't even have citizenship. They're just, it's just straight up like Islamophobia. It's like, good. I've been indoctrinated in this very controlled post 9/11 system, and this is what I totally accept. And of course, there's always going to be, as I said, edgelords, but there are a disturbing number of people looking at this catastrophe and, just enjoying the spectacle. And there's a lot of Americans who are mad about the aid port too. So that's something we have to remind ourselves. It's not this epidemic, this ideological epidemic, is more widespread than just one population center in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yeah,
absolutely. And in terms of action on the ground, it's important to note that any sort of racist rhetoric, even, let alone acts or anything endangering civilians or treating people in any way that is less than humane, it's the responsibility of NCOs and officers in a professional military to check that and police it on the ground. And then it's the responsibility of the military justice system, and then the society, as well as the national government, to enforce that. And of course, even with that system existing, atrocities happen around the world. But the fact is, there's just no incentive at any level of society to enforce the laws of war or just basic humanity.
Yeah, but also as we wrap up here, dude, we've got like 21-year-old captains, like infantry captains, on the ground. We've got 20-year-old master sergeants. We've seen the ranks that they release. Like, I don't know what kind of accountability. I mean, in Ranger Regiment, I was still a specialist at like 21. So. And I still felt like too like emotionally immature to handle it. So yeah, there's just a lack of maturity. There's a lack of age. There's a lack of experience on the ground. And those guys are scared. They're scared. They're freaking terrified. So of course they're going to want to shoot first. And then because they're so scared, they're going to want to try and assert their authority, power, and domination over a captive population, because again, they want to feel powerful because they feel scared, and like they don't know what they're doing because they don't know what they're doing. And again, also when it comes to controlling the freaking privates, there isn't an NCO corps. It doesn't look like a NATO military. It looks like something in the Eastern Bloc where you have officers and then a bunch of privates. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, it's just not a professional military, and they're surrounded by thousands of starving people, and it's only going to get worse. But to kind of close on, like, is there any rumors about the Rafah assault? Because Netanyahu says it's going to happen. I've heard Friday. That's when people think it's going to happen inside Gaza. I don't know if you've heard anything on the other side of the border.
I have not, and you wouldn't hear that kind of thing here, because that kind of open, like, political discourse just doesn't really exist. So I have not heard anything besides the open sources that you would see yourself. But it seems like it's imminent, and it seems like the Egyptian government has been for several weeks now constructing walls and barriers and potential camps to manage the consequences of an assault on Rafah.
Just one question I had, with your experience on the ground, what was one conversation that you can pull off the top of your head with one of the truckers that really, you know, stood out to you on a very personal, sentimental, emotional level? That left an impact.
It was actually I was just kind of astounded by the positive attitude of some drivers that I saw along the road, that they stopped and they were welcoming me, offering me tea. They were excited and proud to talk about their work. And it's not, I don't have a story really about something so awful that really sticks with me. But the thing that really sticks with me is against all of this, this hardship and these challenges and the danger they face at a personal level, these guys were maintaining a completely positive attitude and excited to do their job. So I was just really inspired by that, and I saw that throughout all of my conversations with these drivers. It was almost universal.
I bet it's unfathomable for us Americans to think of doing a job like that. We would demand hazard pay up the ass for a job like that and all kinds of bonuses. But these guys think of how much they're getting paid. They're not getting paid that much.
No, they get paid next to nothing. There's huge problems with the economy, and they're camped along the side of the road waiting on permission to move to the next step and doing it in the best way they can. So it's inspiring.
Yeah. Real men right there.
Yeah. But like, not as inspiring as watching John Cena present best costume award naked last night at the Oscars. Right, guys?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Wait, you watched it? I didn't, was it yesterday? It was last night, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't watch it. I saw clips, and then I made a reaction shit post that I posted to Instagram last night, but that's all. That's the only thing from the Oscars I saw, and I was like, nope, no thanks. I'm glad I didn't waste my time doing that. Because, yes, a Rafah assault is apparently imminent, and then an attack on Hezbollah in southern Lebanon is apparently also imminent, which is absolutely insane. But we're kind of in uncharted territories here, so I no longer try to make a sane analysis. I just go with, okay, what's the craziest shit that they will try, and it might actually happen. So, Ramadan has started today. We're going to try to get this posted ASAP, so it doesn't become irrelevant within, like, 2 hours, because who knows what's going on at this point. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on with us, and we hope to see you again to talk about what's going on the Egypt side of the crossing.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Nice to meet you, Matt.
All right. Yeah. Likewise. All right, y'all, and thanks so much for listening. We'll try to get this posted by this evening, New York City time. All right. Hope to see you again.